Okay.
Today is we're on air.
Yep. Today is July 21st, 2008. My name is Garrett Blauvelt, and I'm interviewing Mr. B.L. Burton about his military experience during World War II. My first question, Mr. Burton, is where and when were you born?
Macon, Georgia. 1919, January 12th.
And could you please tell me a little bit about your childhood? You said you grew up in Gainesville?
Yeah, we stayed in... We wasn't up there but a year and a half. My daddy was managed a jewel tea company in A&P, and he was up there, and I was born when they were up there, and they sent him back to Jacksonville, and I was just a year and a half in Georgia. I was born in Macon, Georgia.
Okay.
In 1919, January 12th.
Okay.
And then moved to back down to Jacksonville. Stayed there about a year and a half, and then into Gainesville. Been here ever since. So.
Okay. Did you go to school in Gainesville then?
Went to school in Gainesville. Went to grammar school, high school, university, and everything right in Gainesville.
Okay. And what did your parents do in Gainesville?
What were my parents doing? They had grocery stores.
Okay.
And I had some too after I got out of the service. I had minute marks. Hey, Phil. Oh, excuse me.
That's okay. What kind of subjects did you like in school? What were your favorite subjects or what activities
most
did you...
Most other than none of them. No, English was good. I never failed an English class during school, but I think I failed every other thing one time or other, but I got through with no problem.
And then you went on to the University of Florida?
Yeah, I got into university and never did graduate. My wife kept getting pregnant, and so I got 3.5 years before I finally had to get out and go to work full time.
When would this have been? Would this have been near when World War II started, or?
No, this was after World War II.
Okay.
Yeah, I was back here then. I didn't know her until I got back here.
Okay. So you had graduated high school, you hadn't gone to college when World War II had started?
No, I didn't go to college until after we got into the GI Bill when I got back out of the service.
Okay.
I went to work, and worked all over. Went up one time to, what was it? Oh, Loon Lake up in Lake Placid. I catted up there. My uncle was safety director in a mine up there, and I went up with him, and I catted doing it up there. The first time I ever had in a golf club, I didn't know anything about golf, but I enjoyed it, and I played it all my life since I got back here.
Okay. And you were doing this up till where were you when Pearl Harbor was attacked? You were in Gainesville?
Well, no, I was in West Palm Beach working at Bass and Tennis Club.
Okay.
And I was going down to Lake Worth, and it came on the radio. And I'd already registered for the draft up in Pickwell, Ohio, where my uncle was safety director in the Stone Corps. But I got drafted down here in Florida because that's where I was working.
Okay. What was your immediate reaction after the attack on Pearl Harbor? Did you know that you were going to be called into service soon?
No, I had no idea at that time.
Okay. And you were signed up for the draft, so that's how you joined the military?
Yeah, I was in the draft and signed for the draft. And I was down there when they attacked Pearl Harbor, and I got drafted. I had no problem with that. I was drafted into the Army.
Okay. And when was this? When were you drafted?
Well, Pearl Harbor was about April the 4th, 42. Pearl Harbor was 41, yeah. Mm-hmm. And April of 42, I was in the, yeah, that's right.
Okay. And what went into your decision to join the Army Air Corps? Was that where they put you, or is that where
well,
you wanted to go?
Well, they did it by IQ deal, the higher your IQ, as I was given... I had a pretty good IQ, not bragging or anything, but they put me in the Air Corps at Biloxi, Mississippi.
And was this immediately after you're drafted, or what's the process before they find out?
No, I did basic training at Biloxi, Mississippi, where they sent us on the train. Got the basic training there.
And you did the regular Army basic training?
Yeah, regular Army basic training.
Okay. And what was that like at the time? What was a typical day like
Well,
in basic
it
training?
was out in the swamps of Louisiana, and we were in tents, and it wasn't anything but mosquitoes, and it was very miserable out
Okay.
And we were tickled to death when we got out of it. We had 2 weeks of basic training, and then I was sent from there to Walla Walla, Washington. Never seen snow, been out in the state of Florida hardly, and they sent me all the way to Walla Walla, Washington from there.
And this
Well,
is.
I went to Scottsville, Illinois, and had 22 weeks of radio school.
Okay.
And from there, they sent me to Walla Walla, Washington.
Okay, so after they do basic training, is that when they did
Yeah,
the IQ test?
after the basic training, I got down in Louisiana.
Okay. And they did an IQ test, and they said you're qualified for the Army Air Corps, and then they
Yeah.
sent you to Illinois first.
Yeah. I think I had 126 IQ or something, and they said, well, you be going into the Air Corps. So I said, that's fine with me. I didn't know at the time I was going to be flying all over the place. But
Did you have any experience flying or any interest in flying before this?
No, I'd never been off the ground.
Okay.
Got it all right there.
And did you know you were going to be a radio operator immediately?
No,
or?
They put me into a radio class, and then I learned the Morse code, and had to take over. You had to pass so many words, I think 16 words a minute to get out of it, and putting down dot dash and Morse code. I don't know whether you've ever learned the Morse code or not, but so you had to have an ear for that.
Okay. And they'd already removed you from the rest. The Army Air Corps had already removed pilots to one place and navigators to another place, and radio went to another place. Is that?
Yeah. Scottsville was strictly radio.
Okay. And you were there for, you said 22 weeks?
22 weeks.
Okay.
I was there and learned to be a radio operator. Well, that's when they sent me to Walla Walla, Washington. And they wanted a cadre to go down to Redmond, Oregon. They sent 35 of us down there and opened a base in Redmond, Oregon, which is still there now today. The base that we opened back there is still there as the municipal airport at Redmond, Oregon.
Okay. And was this in Oregon? Was this the first time you had the opportunity to fly?
Yeah.
Did they start piecing together?
No. When I came back from Redmond on the train to Fort Wayne, Indiana, that's when I first got the opportunity. Fort Wayne, Indiana, they sent me down to Grenada, Mississippi, and we trained in the planes down there. And you had radio, and then when we were going over, they went down to Morrison Field, stayed there, and got onto a crew. There was five people on the crew members of a C-47.
Okay.
Pilot, co-pilot, radio operator, navigator, and the crew chief. And they formed crews down there, and that's when I got on as a crew member on the C-47.
And were these crews, was the crew that you had in Mississippi, was that the same one that you kept for the entire time you were in the service, or did they change
no,
very much?
No, got changed. I finally got me a good pilot. I had a bad one at first, and I finally got me a good one. Art Coulter from Schenectady, New York, and he got us together. The first one I had, he was a show-off, and they shipped him out. As he thought he was God Almighty behind the airplane. Busted up two of them, so they shipped them out in Pathfinder School, where they put the So I got me a good pilot, and he told us he had a child born since he got in the service, and he wanted to come home. If we didn't want to come home, don't get on his crew. So I went over and stood beside him.
I guess the next question is, regarding the crews, are the Army Air Corps is doing IQ tests to find people, so are most of these people, are there a lot of college graduates on the crew or college students?
Oh, yeah,
there
were a lot of college graduates.
Okay. And your crew was, you said that the crew you were eventually with, the pilot was from Schenectady, New York.
He was from Schenectady, New York, yeah.
Was the co-pilot the same, or?
The co-pilot was from New York. It was, and Emil Cox, he was from the crew chief, he was in Cincinnati, Ohio. And the navigator, we had a couple of different navigators. I can't remember exactly where they were from.
Now. Okay.
But when you had the lead ship, they always had a navigator. If you were just a wingman or something, they had one navigator for the lead ship, and the other two didn't have navigators.
Okay.
They were a little harder to train. Well, I mean, a navigator got to be a pretty smart man.
And you met this crew. This crew was still before you had gone over. You were with the crew that you served with in Europe. You met them in the United States, correct?
See, I went across, came down to England. Now, I think in England, when we first got over there, I got onto this crew that I went the rest of the time with.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit to after you first started flying. About how many hours do they put the crew before they send you to Europe? What was that like, the training, once they put the crew together?
Well, I don't think it was in a set number of hours, but we learned to assemble in the dark, because we drop parachute at 1:15 in the morning, and it's dark. So we spent hour after hour at night forming up each other there over England. And be able to join up together, because all you had lights on there doing there, it was blackout everywhere. You got four starlights on your wings, and they're covered. Only way you can see them is when you're in position back here, and they look just like stars. They're the same color as stars.
Okay.
And there's four of them on the wings of the C-47, and your pilot better stay right up there where they could see those. But if you didn't, you're in trouble.
Especially if you didn't have the navigator. That
yeah.
would be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how long for your plane? How long were you? How long had you flown in the United States before you were sent over? Just an estimate, I guess.
Let me see. Well, we did a lot of training down in Grenada, Mississippi. I don't know exactly how many hours. We wasn't down there 2 or 3 weeks in Grenada training before we were sent on down to Morrison Field and put on, and then down into Taos, and then straight across. We did a lot of training after we got over into England there, because we were getting ready to. Can't think now when I got into England. It's all on my record. I can go back and find out, but it's
okay. So, what would the typical day be in Mississippi when you were training? What was it like? Did they have you do most of the work at night to practice flying at
night?
Well,
no, we just learned to. We would take bags of flour and drop them on the people down there to see. It wasn't a sophisticated training they have nowadays and everything, but if you got splattered with flour from playing, you were casualty then. We'd drop bags of white flour down there and on the troops down there. And it wasn't as sophisticated as it is now in the training and everything.
Okay.
So that's the way we really trained. And we slept in pup tents down there. They wasn't long enough for your feet inside. Your feet were always sticking out there in the little pup tents they had or something. I enjoyed it. I wouldn't want to do it again, but I'm glad I did, and it's over with.
Okay. And when did they just notify you? Did someone come in and say you're flying over to Europe, or how was that done?
Let's see, how did it come about? Well, we got down there and got on a cruise, and we knew that we were going over. We didn't know where or when. And then they sent us to the Natal, Brazil, and that's where we left from there. And we found out we were going across. They used to stop at Ascension Island, but they put extra gas tanks in the back of our C-47, and we flew straight across. We didn't stop at Ascension Island. That's out in the middle of the South Atlantic over there, a little old island. Most of the planes and bombers all stopped there and refueled. But we had 30 minutes of flying time, gas left when we hit Dakar, Africa. That's all we had left in the tanks. So we made it.
What was the flight like? I know I've read some other crews where they said that the navigator sometimes would be, the pilot would couldn't fly the whole time, so the co-pilot would fly part of the time.
No, co-pilot would swap places with them occasionally when they, yeah, the co-pilot. You had to have two pilots in case one got, but he, our pilot, Dayard Coley, he said, I want every one of you to learn to fly this airplane. Mm-hmm. And he did. He made us even to shoot landings and take off, because he said, if I get hit, I want somebody to bring their plane down, or if all of us get hit or something. And we had plenty of chances to get hit, because I had 28 missions where we were shot at. So.
So is this during training where he would have taught you how to fly, or was this something that the Army Air Corps did with
this? No, this is what the pilot did okay. for himself. He wanted us to be able to land that plane and take it off, each one of the crew members. So he would make us do it, and while we're on training flights, he'd put one of us in the pilot seat and let us fly the damn airplane. But
okay.
I didn't have any official real pilot training. I tried to, but I didn't have enough teeth in my head, and I couldn't get into flight school. So I ended up being the radio operator the whole time.
Okay, so
which I have no regrets about being.
Okay, so when you landed in Africa, where did you fly to next? Was that direct to England?
We landed in Dakar, Africa, and flew up to a little town called Marrakesh.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that was some town. And then from there, we flew up to Casablanca, and then went out a certain degree into the ocean, because we had to go around Spain. And the Germans still had Spain, so we would fly out to a certain parallel where their fighters couldn't come out and have gas enough to go back. So I forget what the parallel was, that we would go out into the Atlantic Ocean going around Spain and then go up past England and come back on the backside, because the Germans still had all of France and everything, and they had all their Messerschmitts and everything based right in Spain there. And they could come out just so far with the gas they had and have to turn around and go back. So we knew what parallel it was. Mama, don't eat all my crab claws.
I'm just selling them.
Okay.
So did you stop in Marrakesh for a little bit, or what?
Yeah, just overnight.
Okay. And then you stopped again in Casablanca?
And in Casablanca, we were just overnight there.
So you didn't have an opportunity to see any of those places. It was just land at the airfield,
no,
get refueled, and then go on.
We didn't have that sightseeing time at all.
And how many planes would have been flying with you? Was it just your plane, or how many planes were flying along?
Usually three.
Okay.
We would have about three in a group. And then, well, later on, I went down stationed in Italy, and I got to go up to land on Gibraltar up there, and that big old runway goes right out into the middle of the sea there. That was something. Boy, you come out behind that mountain and the old wind would catch that plane, blow it off. They just had a long runway that they put out in the Isle of Gibraltar there. And, some of them went over. I mean, it was a scary strip to land on. In fact, it was 20 feet high, and when you come in, it was just a big old 20-foot concrete wall. You had to touch down quick, because you didn't have too much runway out there ahead of you.
This whole experience flying over, what did it feel like for you, you hadn't had a whole lot of flying experience.
Well, just flying over straight across, all I did was sit back in the back there and listen to see if that plane sputtered or anything. We didn't want it to sputter or go. That's all we did.
Did a lot of planes have mechanical issues, or how frequent would that have been?
We had some that went down before they got over there. They run out of gas if you hit a headwind. Luckily, like I said, we had 30 minutes of flying gas left in the plane when we landed in Dakar, Africa.
And since
we got any kind of headwind or anything, we'd have been out of it too. But.
And since there were three planes, did your plane have the navigator, or would one of the other planes have the navigator?
No, the lead plane had the navigator.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We didn't have one on at that time.
Okay. And then you came up along back into England.
Yeah.
Okay.
And landed at Bath, England, over on the backside. Well, there was another little town we actually landed at, but it was near Bath.
Okay. And this would have been early 1944 or late 1943? What time of
year? Late 1943, because 1944 was when we had the war ended in 44, yeah, April. Yeah, we got over there in
Well, how soon before D-Day had you arrived in England?
Probably about 6 months. We had about 6 months of flying time around in England, getting used to all the stuff they had. England had more different navigational aids than anything that you've ever seen in your life. They had all kind of ways to navigate. Because, Lord, you'd take off, and 10 minutes after you took off, your base was engulfed in fog, and so they had a lot of different ways of navigating in England.
Okay, so you would have arrived in England probably, that would have been like December of 1943, something like that, maybe January.
It would have had to been in about the middle of 43, I guess.
Okay. And then you got there, you started working on navigational aids first. Is that one of the first things that you had to train on, is different ways to find your base?
We had to learn the downward recognition lights on things, and they had them down there flashing. We knew the Morse code, and that's what they use. So we had to learn all their navigational aids, and they could have one where they'd take a searchlight, turn it down like this, and you'd follow that searchlight beam to the next field. And like I said, they had every kind of that fog. I mean, people talk about that pea soup fog. They had it. Didn't realize it till I got over there, but you couldn't hold your hand this way and couldn't see your hand from your face.
Okay. And about what period of time did you know what you were going to do? Did you know that you would eventually be dropping paratroopers, or when did this...
Yeah, they began to train us, those parachutes. We knew we were going to be carrying parachutes and have parachuters and paratroopers. So We dropped a lot of them over here before we left to go over there.
Okay. So you had some experience even before you went over doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And just information on a C-47, about how many people could fit on a C-47?
You had the 5-man crew. 23 fully loaded paratroopers.
Okay.
Because they weighed about 300 pounds apiece with all their equipment and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the bucket seats on each side, and you could hold 23. And you always had these bundles and everything. They call them power bundles. They were attached under the planes. And we had bundles inside that when they went out, we had to push these bundles behind us. The crew chief and myself, and we'd push them out so they'd all quicker, where they'd be closer together, you know. They wanted them where they could get to them right quick.
And what would be the procedure for dropping a paratrooper? What would happen on the plane when you would getting ready to drop somebody?
Well, we would go down first thing between 600, 900 feet, we'd drop them. They wanted to get to the ground fast.
Okay.
And we'd go down usually around 900 feet. They were ready to go out that door, and they stood in that door, boy, one right after the other, and when it had a red light and a green light right by the door, we took the doors off and we made drops. And when that green light was on, red light was on, they were standing there ready. And when that green light came on, they all pushed each other out. They would out of there so quick you wouldn't even know it if you...
Okay.
And they landed that way, they stayed close together. It was made, the static line, we call it, would go just beyond the tail, and that would open the chute. See, they didn't have to open the chute.
Mm-hmm.
When they jumped out, the chute was open with the static line just after it got past the tail of the airplane. So there, they maybe sway one time like that, and then they were on the ground.
Which is probably safer when you're dropping from that low. You want to make sure that they can open the chute.
They, during practice, we would usually drop them about 1,500 feet.
Okay.
But when we had a mission like that, they wanted to get down quick, so we would always get down there between 900 and 1,000 feet and drop them. And the only way I'd have gone out of one of them, if it was on fire, I wouldn't have jumped out of one of the darn things. And I helped push a lot of them out of there. But
did you have to drop any parachutists off in England? Did you do any training with that, or... Did you ever have training dropping people as low as you would eventually do that in combat? Or was it always about 1,500 feet practice and then...
No, we trained with them at night. We would actually, they'd bring them over to the field and we'd drop them at night and they'd pick them up and we wouldn't see them again. We trained with live people, yeah.
Okay, and this was happening in England too?
Yeah.
Do you know where in England you would have been flying practice? Did they
it was all over. You couldn't tell where the heck you were. I mean, the pilot and navigator knew where they were. It was between Birmingham and Hungerford. We were stationed at Ramsbury, a little old field up on top of a... It wasn't a mountain. There ain't no mountains in England. Some hills in England. We were at a field called Ramsbury. And
at Ramsbury, this was the 437th Troop Carrier Group,
yeah.
And your squadron part of that. How many planes would have been at Ramsbury?
How many what?
How many planes were there in a squadron?
There was 13 in a squadron when we went over.
Mm-hmm.
And they expected, they didn't tell us that, but they expected 50% to 80% casualties in the plane shot down. 2 weeks after we got over the drop, here come new planes in, and we wondered why, and we ended up with 26 planes in each squadron because we lost less than 1% of the planes that they thought we were going to lose, 50% to nearly 100%. They thought we'd all going to get shot down, so we ended up with 26 planes to the squadron after that.
Okay.
But 13 was the original number of planes in us. In a squadron.
What was the relationship like in England between, first of all, other types of pilots? Was there any kind of rivalry between a fighter pilot, a bomber pilot, or crews?
Well, most all your pilots wanted to be fighter pilots, mm-hmm. sitting up in a... They all wanted to be a fighter pilot, but they didn't all get to be fighter pilots. But that was their ambition, to be fighter pilots.
Was the Troop Carrier Group second choice or third choice, usually, or...
I don't know.
Okay. And was there any, did you ever meet groups, was there anyone stationed nearby where you'd meet bomber crews or you'd meet fighter pilots?
Yeah, there was. It wasn't too far from a B-17 base. And we met some of them. And the first time I saw a jet, they just started, and I thought the plane was on fire. We had engine trouble, was it? A British place standing there, and I saw this plane coming down real low, and I said, "You got one on fire coming in here." And the British that I was talking to, he said, "No, it ain't on fire." He said, "That's a jet." And that thing came in, turned, went straight up out of sight, and that's the first jet I saw.
Wow.
They had just started making them, but that was something else to see, because We would go miles before we'd get up 1,500 feet.
And was this in Ramsbury where you saw the jet?
Yeah, well, it was at another little base. I don't remember the name of the base.
Okay.
Had some engine trouble when we were there getting it worked on. And it was at a British base someplace in Britain.
So was the relationship fairly good between different crew members or American personnel that were over there? Did you get along
with them? Oh, yeah, we got along with them. I'll tell you one thing, everybody got off the sidewalk for when you'd go into London or anyplace else on a pass, and these British paratroopers came down there. We all got off the sidewalk, boy. They were some tough cats in the British paratroopers. We learned to get off the darn sidewalk when they come down
there. Was there anything specific about them? Was it just tough individuals, or
they'd been through more, you know. They had that Dieppe deal, and they had all that stuff there, and them British paratroopers, oh boy, but they were tough. Of course, our paratroopers wasn't babies.
Did you deal with one group more than another, or was it
one group of what?
Of paratroopers. Did you practice with the same group that you would eventually fly over?
No, we dropped the 82nd D-Day, and then we had the 101st and 82nd. But we dropped the 82nd at 1:15 in the morning on over Cherbourg Peninsula.
Okay.
And then we had the 101st another time, and the 501st and the several different paratrooper.
Okay.
Squadrons that were over there. We didn't know which one was going to be on our plane.
You would just fly whoever was on the plane to wherever they told you to fly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So leading up to D-Day, what was happening with you? Did you know where they were going to drop, or was that something only the pilot knew?
Well, they didn't tell us till the day before.
Okay.
And you know, it was supposed to have been June the 5th, and they told us. And then they had some bad weather come in. It had to be the next day. Well, they put us under guard and a barbed wire fence, and they had the latrine was outside of the fence, and if we had to go to the latrine, a pair of MP met us at the gate and walked us over there and stood right there and walked us back after we found out what day it was going to be, which we found out a day early. And then they didn't do it until the second day, June the 6th.
Would the paratroopers have been waiting with you? Were they already there? Or?
Yeah, the paratroopers were already there.
So everyone was there just sitting and waiting for...
They were sitting there waiting. They didn't know any more hard about when they're going to be dropped than we did.
And this is before you knew what they expected the casualties for your planes? Did you know that they were expecting you to lose a lot of planes
no,
at that time?
No, they didn't tell us that story. Okay. We knew. They wasn't about to No, but...
Okay,
they told us later when all them planes started coming in, they expected 50% or better to be shot down, over half of them or more.
So June 6th, if you could just sort of go through what the day would have been like for you. When did you wake up? Had you slept from the day before, or were you anticipating going on this mission that you didn't get much sleep?
Well, we knew that was going, that first one, there was going to be a lot more, which it was. And we got over that one, and they brought us back. Actually, we pulled a glider in that afternoon. We dropped paratroopers early, and they brought us back and let us sleep 2 or 3 hours. And then they hooked the glider on. We pulled a glider over there and dropped it off the coast of the Cherbourg Peninsula. So I made actually 2 trips across there on the D-Day.
Okay. And how long would it have taken you to fly from your base to the Cherbourg Peninsula?
From where we were and where we went down around, it was about nearly an hour and a half. And we had to go down and come back up across the Cherbourg Peninsula. And it was about an hour and a half. And we was only over land, the Cherbourg Peninsula, about 26 miles wide, and we were only over that, I don't know, 20 minutes at the most before we were back out into the ocean on the other side.
Okay, so...
Then we went right down on the water and come right back and got low as we could and come across the channel.
So you would have taken off between 11 and midnight as to fly over and drop the...
Yeah, we had to take off by... We dropped them at 1:15, so it was probably around 11 o'clock or something that night that we had to get all the way over there by 1:15 and drop the paratroopers.
And did you have to meet in a big group, or did you go in groups of three over?
No, we went in a... They had a sky train of about 90 planes that went over there. And, of course, we run into a fog bank right over the drop zone, had to scatter. So we scattered paratroopers all over the place there. But when you hit a fog bank and can't see, the planes had to get away. We were flying. You might have jumped from one plane tip to the other when we were flying close formation, which we did. So
you knew because of the fog that there was going to be problems with...
Well, we didn't know we were going to run into the fog bank right over top of the DZ. No, we hadn't planned on that at all. But
once you saw the fog, you knew there'd probably be some problems.
Well, you had to go right into it, because we were just about ready for them to drop. Pilots had to deal and everything where they could tell right where it was.
Was there any enemy fire while you were getting ready to
get
this first
trip? Oh, yeah, there was old Spent flak coming all over the place, because the first time I was under fire.
And did you was there any protection? Did they have any fighter escort with these
no,
planes?
No, they fighters, they didn't come out. We did later on when we went further in, when they could escort us further into bases further away from the coast. But that night, no, there wasn't anything. But there was searchlights, them big old searchlights. You get caught one of them in that old flak. If it was strong enough, it'd come through the little old height of a C-47. But you could hear that old Spent flak sound like it was hailing on the outside of the airplane.
So you didn't lose many... Your squadron didn't lose many planes this first flight?
No, we lost... We lost one. Wisniewski was the radio operator on that. That's right. We only lost one plane that night.
And did you have any issues with flak? Were there any damages to your plane when you landed? Or
I was the only plane that never got a bullet hole in the squadron. The rest of them come back with just riddled with bullet holes. Mine's the only plane in the squadron. We never picked up a bullet hole.
And when you landed...
And 30 caliber and 50 caliber machine guns that they'd shoot up at. We never got a hole in our ship.
And when you landed, did you know you were going to fly again that day? Did they tell you before you went to sleep?
Oh, it didn't take long for them to let us know that we were going to be going back across there, which we didn't want to do, but we knew we had to.
And this would have been a different situation? You'd
and
be
the
flying?
Second day, we dropped. Some more on the third day, they got it far enough in where we could, they started a little airfield in, we started landing, bringing back the wounded GIs. That was the third day after D-Day. They got a little strip right there on the coast of France. And boy, we started bringing back, those poor old boys that hit the beach, they were burned and everything. And we had nurses, two nurses on each plane there, and they took care of them back over the channel.
Did they prioritize who would fly in planes? Did they put people on boats, and did they put worst cases on planes, or do you know how they did that?
Well, it was one only thing way they had. I mean, all men as we could get, we would bring back. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't any way boats could go back and forth. That channel was so full of boats that you couldn't go across it. I don't know whether you ever saw that longest day and saw all them boats coming across there. Well, that's what it actually looked like. There was just boat after boat after boat out there.
So most of the wounded were going back through planes?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you were taking the people back and bringing supplies there?
We were bringing back the wounded, that's right.
Okay.
And bringing back supplies and stuff when we'd come back over until we had another drop, which was at Eindhoven.
Okay. I had a quick question about the second drop you made on D-Day was gliders. I just wanted to know what the difference would be from your standpoint, flying with paratroopers and flying with gliders. How would the mission be different?
Well, you're pulling the glider behind you. You're going a lot slower, for one thing.
Okay.
And it's just as bad one way or the other.
Okay. And was it similar where you would notify the glider that you were getting? Was there a red light, green light type of situation?
Well, there was a release point on the glider, and the pilot could release them.
Okay.
So it was up to them. We didn't have anything to do about releasing the planes. They could release themselves, or the pilot could release them. So usually there's a rope that's 325 feet long that was from the glider to the plane. And that was the, and we would, when they would drop it, we'd come back and drop those ropes and reuse them, because they were big, heavy ropes. I mean, they were, and they would reuse them to pull the next glider with when they pick them all up. But it could be released from the plane or from the inside the glider also.
Did you have to drop them at a different level? Like, how high would you be to drop a glider?
Well, they wanted a little bit more room because they had to find a place to land.
Okay.
So we would probably go in about 1,500 feet and release those gliders.
And did you have experience working with gliders before you were pulling
them? No, I rode one time. But it's so much difference. You don't have an engine on a glider. And you're used to those engines on a C-47 humming and you. On a glider, all you can hear is a wind stream going by you. It's real quiet on a glider. And they put Jeeps and all that in those gliders. And they had a little... You could put your fist through the side of those gliders. They wasn't anything but canvas, more or less.
And after D-Day happened, when you're making these flights back and forth, about how many flights would you make in a day, or would you make...
I'd hate to say that. Well... Later on, we didn't try not about one time of going across or something, but I flew in that channel so many times, I had no idea how many times I flew the English Channel from the start of the war until the end of it, back and forth. And of course, the narrowest part is 26 miles in there, and the rest of them, they get further away, it takes longer to get across there. Back down towards the Atlantic Ocean, out towards the other side, then the Mediterranean towards that way. A lot wider.
And how long were you flying the D-Day, the wounded personnel back? About how long were you doing this
We brought wounded back from... Well, I mean, we had to keep on because we followed Patton right across there when he was going. We were bringing back wounded all the time, hauling gas over there to him and bringing back the wounded day after day. Yeah, we brought a bunch of wounded people back over there. That's the only way they had to get them back quick. You know. And like I said, we had nurses on those planes then when we were going, knew we had wounded coming back and everything. They took care of them. We could get, I guess we could get 20 stretchers on there. We had a deal there where those stretchers were going up each side of the airplane. We could bring back 20 or 30 wounded with no problem at all.
Okay. And the next combat mission you flew, would that have been, you said Operation
that
Market?
That was at Aachen.
Okay.
Yeah, and Eindhoven, the one where they call the bridge too far at Eindhoven. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we made the drops there.
And how was this different from, was this that different from?
It wasn't any different from it, just as bad. Anytime you're running into plaque or anything, it ain't no.
Did you have to fly over flak for longer for
at
this?
At least you was in the daytime, you could see what was coming up there. Yeah, it kept getting further and further, we would have to go. Mm-hmm. As they went further. And then the last mission, we dropped them at Wesel in Germany. That was the last. We dropped paratroopers one day and pulled a double glider to go the next day. And that was at Wesel over the Rhine River. And that was the last one we made over there. The war ended and we went back and started training troops and new ones coming over. And Then we got to come home. They went let us out on a point system, so many points. But
okay, I just wanted to ask briefly before we end discussing your military experience. How did you feel about the leadership that you had over there? I know you've mentioned briefly that your commander, the plane commander, the pilot, he was very confident in coming back safe. So that sort of carried over to the crew.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel about the squadron and the group commanders? Did you know who they were?
Well, we had the same one. Yeah. Major. What was his name?
Let's see if I have.
I can't recall it right now.
I have for your squadron. For the squadron, there was a Lester Ferguson who was in charge.
Ferguson, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he was the head of the group or squadron. I don't know whether that was a group squad or the, what did I put on there? I don't remember.
He was in charge of the squadron, and there was a colonel.
The colonel was the head.
Colonel Hudgens, followed by a Colonel French.
Yeah, Colonel French was there most of the time. And
did you feel like they were?
Well, I mean, they were well trained for what they did. I mean, at that time we didn't know whether they were good, bad, or dumb. You didn't have any choice of who you gonna fly with.
You just flew the mission and
so
came
you
back.
You took well. But we did have one bad pilot, but they got rid of him. He was a stupid guy.
When these new planes came after D-Day, did they have the same amount of experience as you, or did you ever feel that they were putting people in that might not have had as much experience as you had? Did you get a sense that there was any difference in training?
After D-Day, no, I wasn't in that D-Day. They began to get us. Of course, we had to go down to southern France, and we went down, we're based in Italy, and dropped paratroopers over there on southern France, and then we came back up, and we were stationed right outside of Rome, and the Germans still had up at Florence up there, you could hear the guns where we were stationed in the Tyrrhenian Sea there, where we put up a tent, and then we had to go up and drop troopers on southern France, which came around behind the Germans. But most of the resistance was over with by then, and we wasn't getting shot at or anything else harder than.
Okay. And did your squadron always have the C-47? Did you ever change planes?
No, the C-47 is all we had. That's what the troop carrier was made up of, C-47.
Okay.
It was a good plane, one of the best they had. It could stand a lot of punishment.
And then you mentioned a little earlier that the point system was used, and that's when you found out you were going home.
You got so many points for each month you're over there, and for each mission you went on, and for each medal you got. And so I ended up and got out. Well, man, old boy from Texas, Blakely, we had the most points in the squadron, and we got out first. They put us on up to Antwerp, put us on a boat, sent us to Boston, on 10 days across the North Atlantic on that boat, and we landed in Boston, and they put us on a train. We came to Jacksonville, Florida, and my sister met me there and drove me down to Gainesville, and that was it. She lived in Jacksonville.
And you were just out of the service then, or was that?
No, we're still in the service.
Okay.
I had to go back to Greensboro, North Carolina, and get taken out of service because Blanding was full.
Mm-hmm.
I got out in Augusta, Georgia.
Okay, and do you know when that would have been, around what time of the year that would have been?
Got it down someplace, okay. But I can't remember just what it was.
And then after this was over, what did you do when you got back? You said that you used the GI
Came
Bill
back
eventually.
Went to work.
Okay.
Just as quick as I could.
And then eventually you went to school for a little bit to the university?
Well, yeah. When I got back, I went ahead and signed up on the GI Bill and went to the university out there for 3.5 years. Like I said, we began to get a family, and I had to work more, so I couldn't, I didn't want to fly anymore anyhow, so it didn't bother me. I had all the flying I wanted after that.
So you didn't want to go back into
it? I haven't been off the ground but once since then. Went to Las Vegas one time, and I got back from here, and I said that was it. And I have nothing against flying, don't get me wrong. That's the easiest, best way to get there, but I just don't fly anymore.
Well, I think you've used up the airtime I think you had in a few years is probably what people have in a lifetime.
That's right. Yep, 3,300 hours is a long time to sit up them damn airplane.
And what have you done in Gainesville? Where have you worked in Gainesville?
Well, I had grocery stores, and then I got into the dry cleaning. I was in the dry cleaning business for 17 years. Rips cleaners around here. That's what I retired from in 86, and I've been retired since 1986.
And when did you get involved in veterans organizations? I know you're with the D-Day Veterans now.
I helped organize this D-Day Veterans group that we meet over there. I was one of the charter members of organizing that. And we meet once a month at the Conestoga over there in Lodgeway. We used to have 54 members, now and we're down to 7. If we get 7, we're lucky. Because they all dying off. I mean, they're losing. We're losing 1,000 a day. Now it's up to 1,200 a day of veterans are being.
So was this the first group that you were involved in with the veterans group?
Or? Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, I went to American Legion one time, but I didn't care much about it. I didn't stay in the American Legion.
Do you see do you notice that a lot of veterans are becoming involved in these groups, or is that?
Well, you had VFW and the American Legion after the war. VFW is still around, but the American Legion's here, but they don't have any in it hardly anymore. Mm-hmm. But we organized this group over there, and we have had a good time with it since we started. And we meet once a month, like I said, over there at Conestoga.
How do you feel about your contribution to the war effort, looking back at it?
My contributions? I did it because I was drafted, and if I had to do it again, they'd have to draft me again. I'd never volunteer. But I think I served my purpose, and once I got into it, it didn't bother me too much. I figured when he's going to call you, he's going to call you from up there anyhow, so it's all written someplace. Here I am now, 90 years old, and I'm still here. So
I think what we've noticed, I've noticed in some of the interviews that we've had, is that a lot of the people who are pilots it was sort of just that kind of feeling, exactly. When it's your time, it's your time.
That's more or less the way most. Well, you better take it that way. If you run scared all the time, you're not.
And I also wanted to ask: has the way Americans view World War II changed? And how should people look back at what your generation accomplished in the 1940s? What should people?
Most people seem to appreciate it. And I have a D-Day pin that I wear a lot of times, and a lot of people stop me and say, "Were you there?" And so they do think about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had several different ones stop me. Let me shake your hand. So I think everybody appreciates it more or less.
Okay. Well, those are all the questions that I have. If you have anything else you'd like to mention, we could do that right now. If you have any other...
No, I think we've covered it pretty good. I had 3 times that I didn't think I was going to get back, but I did. So one time I was sitting there with C-47. Crew Chief Emil Cocker sitting over here, and we were in the back, and we'd just crossed over into Holland. I couldn't hear what he was saying harder, so I got up and went on and sat down beside him, and I hadn't been there 2 minutes. German 88 came right up through that seat I had been sitting in.
Wow.
Went out the top, didn't explode, and if I'd have been sitting there, I wouldn't have been here today, but I don't know what made me get up and go and sit down behind it. Another time, we threw through plane in front of us, bogged down over and around Brussels in the wet runway, and we were fixing to land, and he bogged down right in the front runway, so the pilot took off through the bushes and the weeds and held it on the ground till he'd get back flying speed, and we cut down 4 posts and 12 strands of barbed wire, and still stayed in the air. And one other time, a firebund was going over the English Channel, one of the parachutes, a 30-foot parachutes on those bundles,
mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden the airspeed began to drop down to nothing, and we were doing 145, and it got down to 100 and down to 90 degrees, and he was having a hard time keeping. Another plane came over and pointed down to us, and I went back and looked out the door, and one of them parachutes had come fully. We were pulling a 30-foot parachute behind us, and it slowed the plane down, so he had to drop those power bundles, and we picked back up. If we hadn't let those go, we would have been down the channel for long. So that's 3 times that I thought that I wasn't going to make it, or shouldn't have made it. But I did, and I'm back, and that's over with. What else?
Those were my questions. I want to thank you very much for letting me come over here and speak with you.
Have you interviewed the other one?
I'm going to interview a few more in the next few days.
Some of those from our group?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right.